My name is Dick Miller. I teach in philosophy, and I'm director of the program in Ethics and Public Life. Welcome to the last in our series of distinguished public lectures on deep issues of the 2012 elections. I hope you've come to previous lectures in the series, and I hope that you agree that they shed a lot of light on these deep issues. But there are two ways in which we've been seriously deficient. In one way, we've imitated a certain shallowness in the elections themselves, the failure to talk about poverty. In the presidential debates, it seemed that everyone in the United States was either middle class or a rich job creator. You can see how that made sense, that limitation in the discussion in terms of electoral politics in the United States. But in terms of American realities, it makes no sense at all. 15% of the people of the United States live below our rather ungenerous poverty line. That's 46 million people. We're not all middle class, evidently, or rich job creators. 58% of Americans will be poor, below that ungenerous poverty line, for at least 1 year of their lives. President Obama, I think, was referring to some of these people by a euphemism. At one point, I was listening very closely when he talked about people who were striving to be middle class. That's as far as things got in the presidential debates, but we can be deeper. We must be deeper and talk about poverty. There's another way in which we've been very deficient. The presidential campaigns, everybody agreed, were primarily about the economic realities of life in the United States. We have not had an economist speak to us so far. I can think of no one better to fill both of these gaps than our speaker today, Hillary Hoynes. She has shed great light from the perspective of economics on the nature and the causes of poverty and economic insecurity and the effectiveness of programs to alleviate them. She can speak to both our worries and our hopes about these two great issues of the presidential campaigns. I'm delighted that she can come to complete our series, and for the reasons I've mentioned, complete it in a very deep sense. To introduce Professor Hoynes, George Boyer will speak to you about her distinguished career. George is professor of economics and international and comparative labor in the School of Industrial and Labor Relations.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be able to introduce Hillary Hoynes. I want to begin by relating an event that took place 21 years ago in my office. ILR's labor economics department at the time was looking to hire a junior labor economist, and we had out a candidate from Stanford. Didn't happen to be Hillary. We had a candidate from Stanford, and at the end of my half-hour interview with her, she said to me, "You know, the person you guys should be hiring is a graduate student at Stanford who will be on the market next year. Her name is Hillary Hoynes." I've never understood why this woman said this to me, although it turns out that she was a very good judge of talent. The following year, indeed, the Labor Economics Department invited Hillary to Cornell for a job talk. Unfortunately for us, several top economics departments in the country made her a similar invitation, and during her time at Cornell, she had developed a certain fondness for the West Coast, so she graciously declined our invitation. Hillary is a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, and co-editor of the American Economic Review, the top journal in economics. She's a senior research affiliate of the National Poverty Center and a research associate or affiliate of the National Bureau of Economic Research, the Joint Center for Poverty Research at the University of Chicago and Northwestern, the University of Wisconsin's Institute for Research on Poverty, and the Institute for Fiscal Studies at University College London. Apparently, these positions leave her some free time to devote to other activities, as she also currently serves on the National Advisory Committee of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Scholars in Health Policy Research Program and the Advisory Committee for the National Science Foundation's Directorate for the Social, Behavioral, and Economic Sciences. Hillary specializes in the study of poverty, inequality, and the effects of government, tax, and transfer programs on low-income families, as Dick has already told you. She has published numerous articles on these topics in the American Economic Review, Econometrica, the Journal of Public Economics, the Journal of Economic Perspectives, the Review of Economics and Statistics, and other major economics journals. For those of you who prefer less quantitative work, and looking in the audience, I suspect that's many of you, she has a very interesting and readable paper entitled Who Suffers During Recessions in the summer 2012 issue of the Journal of Economic Perspectives. Hillary currently is working on projects evaluating the impact of the Great Recession across demographic groups, examining the impact of the earned income tax credit on infant health, and estimating the effects of U.S. food and nutrition programs on labor supply, health, and human capital accumulation. As Dick has hinted at, while many economists have an invisible hand, unfortunately, many also have an invisible heart. Hillary is not one of those, fortunately for us. Her heart is very visible, and she looks at really important topics. I want to end on a personal note. I've known Hillary for more than 30 years. Her father, Jeffrey Williamson, supervised my PhD dissertation, so he is my academic father. Thus, Hillary and I are related in an odd sort of way. I don't think there's an official term for it, but I consider Hillary my academic half-sister. Hillary will be speaking to us this afternoon on poverty and the safety net after the Great Recession. Please join me in welcoming Professor Hillary Hoynes.
That's a good term. Thank you very much, Dick and George, for that great introduction. It's wonderful to be here in Ithaca, and especially since this time I only had to fly in from Madison, Wisconsin last night, where I was for Thanksgiving, as opposed to flying across the country. So it's great to be here. So what I'd like to talk about, I think Dick sort of summarized it really well. There's going to be some worries and some hope. I'm fundamentally an optimistic person, perhaps sometimes too much for my own good. And in putting together my thoughts to bring here today, I want to start with the reality of poverty in America, what it is, where it comes from, why we should care. And then I want to delve down a little bit into trying to identify what the sources of poverty are in a sort of deep way. And then the optimistic part near the end of the talk about what policies we have that we actually can document are effective in reducing poverty. So perhaps the question is, if we care about it, we could perhaps spend more on these types of programs and reduce poverty further. So where I'd like to start out is just in talking about the facts about poverty and measurement and trends in poverty over time in the United States, and then talk more about these government policies. So in 2011, the most recent year, we measure poverty on an annual basis in the United States. And in 2011, more than 1 in 5 children in the United States lived in poverty. And overall, about 15% of persons were poor in the United States. Yet on the surface, we spend quite a lot of money on anti-poverty programs. So for example, we spend about $30 billion a year on TANF, or cash welfare. Another almost $60 billion on the earned income tax credit, which is a tax-based credit for low-income families. And in the midst of the Great Recession, over $70 billion on food stamps. So what I would like to do is sort of talk about the facts, talk about the programs, and then try to discuss why some programs seem to work better than others, in reducing poverty. I don't know if my arm touched the thing or what. So let's start by defining poverty and be clear on how we define poverty in the US. And then I'll show you some basic trends and facts about how poverty varies across groups. And then really spend the meat of our time in the second half where we talk about the importance of the labor market in terms of its relationship to poverty, and then in government policies. So to start, it's important to point out, first of all, that the United States measures poverty in a, quote, absolute sense, as opposed to a relative sense. So poverty is a family concept. We essentially take the individuals who are related to one another who are living together, and we count up all of their income across all the individuals in the household. And it's important to note that the official poverty definition in the United States is based only on cash income pre-tax. And I'll get back to that. But the official poverty statistics, the one where we say that currently 15% of people are poor, is based on a poverty measure where we just count up essentially the earnings and any sort of cash transfers that individuals get. Say Social Security or cash welfare would be included in that, but food stamps and the earned income tax credit would not. Food stamps is not cash. The earned income tax credit works through the tax system. So I'm going to come back to that. But the basic official poverty definition collects all those income components across everybody in the household and then classifies a family as poor if their income lies below a threshold. And that threshold varies by how big your family is and is updated from one year to the next based on basic changes in the price actually of food. And so this measure in 2011, just to give you an idea of the magnitudes, if you're a single parent living with one child, you would be considered poor if your cash pre-tax income is below about $15,500. Whereas if you had a family of four, it would be about $23,000. And to give you an idea about that magnitude, the median income in the United States for the same year was about $50,000. So it gives you some idea about the magnitudes. Now, the poverty measure, almost since the very beginning of its definition in 1962, has been criticized. And I'll come back to that as I discuss government policies that seem to be effective in reducing poverty. And first and foremost is that the measure of poverty is based on this cash income measure. And one of the things I want to talk to you about is that over time in the US, we're spending, at least for families with children, we're spending less and less aid in terms of cash, almost none, and more aid in kind, say in things like health insurance, expanding health insurance for low-income population, the food stamps program that I've already talked about, and really centrally, moving away from cash welfare type assistance for the poor and instead into spending much more through the tax system. And that's what I want to make sure we have a lot of time to talk about in the second half of the talk. So as the US has made this transformation from cash-based assistance towards other measures of assisting the poor, the old official poverty measure is not really up to the task of measuring what those programs do because it's based only on cash pre-tax income. And so happily, last year, the Census Department released a new, doesn't replace the official poverty figure, but it's now to be released every year with the poverty statistics, and it's called the Supplemental Poverty Measure. And that new measure now incorporates various in-kind transfers and also the tax system. And so we'll talk about that and what difference it makes for the measurement of poverty and for our ability to evaluate what these programs do. There's a lot of other criticisms of our way of measuring poverty that to some extent the new measure addresses. For example, it does not vary, the official measure does not vary across any place in the United States. Some places have much higher costs of living than others, and that's not incorporated in the measure, for example. So we'll come back to some of these issues as we go forward. So now with that basic sort of measurement issue aside, let's take a look at how poverty has varied over the 5 decades that we've been measuring poverty in the United States, and then look at how it varies across groups. So the quite remarkable thing about this figure is that since 1960, other than the initial period of about, you know, 5 or 6 years in the early 1960s, which coincides with the growth and introduction of the Great Society period, poverty has remained, while cyclical, that is, higher in periods of recession and lower in periods of expansion, is really not changed very much. And so a glance at this figure, along with the facts about how much money we spend on anti-poverty programs and how they've varied over time, leads some to conclude, what in the world are we doing spending all this money on these programs, given that it's obviously not changing poverty at all? So observation one is that this poverty measure cannot adjust to the growth of in-kind programs because it doesn't measure that. And this has always been something that is just missed in the public debate about poverty and the effectiveness of anti-poverty programs. But until recently, we haven't really had a measure that experts and others can point to say, okay, let's look at this measure and then evaluate the safety net. So I'll be able to give you some evidence about that today. However, the differences in poverty across groups and the gains over the period are very different across groups. So quite dramatically, the group with the highest poverty rates in the United States tend to be children. Interestingly, the elderly have the lowest poverty rates. And if you take that, this is, whenever I'm showing you a diagram like this, it's just gonna be for the most recent year, which is for 2011. Before showing you what the trends in poverty look like for these two groups, I do want to just point one thing out. So up here I've got the blue bar, which is the poverty rate, which is the fraction of people in that group who are poor. The red bar is the fraction of the poor that are in this group. And I like to use this, it's like a really great example of how people can use statistics to whatever argument they want to make. So because people between the ages of 18 and 64 are such a large majority of people in the population, even though their poverty rate is relatively low, their share of all poor is high. So we can say the typical poor person is between 18 and 65, but that's a very different statement than a statement about the incidence of poverty. So I would argue that the blue line is the thing that we want to pay attention to, the blue bars, but it's sort of just an interesting statistic fact to point out. Now, if we take these different groups by age and think about and plot out what the poverty rates look like for these groups, again, over this time period for the years in which they've been measured, something quite dramatic comes out. And that is that much of the gain, persistent gain in poverty that we've seen in the United States is concentrated among the elderly. And I'm going to come back to that, but the research has shown pretty much unequivocally that that's due to Social Security. So Social Security clearly predates this period. It started in 1935. But during the 1960s and mostly early 1970s, there was a dramatic increase in the generosity of Social Security, which pretty much falls in lockstep with the gains in poverty among the elderly. So really, one of the punchlines that I want you to walk away from today is not that poverty is this incredibly challenging problem that we have no idea how to solve. It really is not that difficult. At the same time, what we see here with the poverty rates of children, it's looking much more persistently high than it is among the elderly. But it's quite important to note that in contrast, back in the 1960s and early 70s, the poverty rate of the elderly vastly surpassed the poverty rate of children and was considered to be a first-order problem in the United States. So in a way, I think, I don't want to say we've solved that problem, but we've provided a lot of protection for the poverty of individuals over age 65 in the United States. So for my talk today, I'm really going to be focusing on children and families with children more generally, because this is where the bigger challenges remain. So we can also just quickly look and see how poverty rates vary across other groups, and I'm sure this will all not be very surprising to individuals in this room, that we have higher poverty rates among ethnic minorities, lower poverty rates among whites and Asians, very much higher poverty rates in families with just one adult, one parent, which is a pretty natural extension of the fact that there's only one potential earner in the household, but maybe also due to other factors. The difference in the poverty rates that you see here between married couples and female-headed households, that fact alone leads many to conclude that the greatest anti-poverty program we could create is to just get all these single parents married, and that would sort of solve the problem. But of course, a keen social scientist would know that there could be a lot of selection into who is currently married and who is currently non-married. So it's not necessarily the case that extending marriage in some magic wand would reduce the poverty rate of individuals living in single-parent families currently. It may not. We would certainly need to know a lot more before we could make that conclusion. It's also the case that immigrants, and particularly non-citizen immigrants, have quite high poverty rates in the U.S., and you can see that on the furthest right on this graph. It should also, of course, come as no surprise to anybody in this room that education provides strong protection against poverty. And this is something I want to come back to in talking about the importance of the labor market and trends in income and earnings and inequality in the United States and how it relates to poverty. So among individuals with much lower education levels, we see much higher poverty rates than in individuals with higher education levels. So now that we've sort of established the basic facts about poverty, I want to just speak very briefly about why it's something that we should care about from a perspective of social welfare, society at large, other kinds of issues that might be correlated with poverty. So it's obviously a measure that essentially all developed countries provide and is a typical part of the well-being measures that any country would publish for 1 year to the next. It's very clear that children who grow up poor are much more likely to experience many adverse outcomes, and I've listed many of them on this slide that have been investigated. They're less likely to attend preschool, perform less well in school, ultimately have some connection to child welfare system or government assistance or incarcerated, have much worse health and lower life expectancy. However, again, it's quite challenging in order to causally identify whether it's poverty that is leading to these worse outcomes or whether it's some other characteristics. And that's sort of the challenge, a first-order challenge of the social scientist, is to come up with convincing research designs that allow us to try to disentangle the channel of poverty from other measures. Just to give you an idea about the magnitude of some of these differences, I'm reporting here a graph from a paper by Greg Duncan and Catherine Magnuson. And what I show here is the risk of all these outcomes are bad outcomes. And what I'm showing here, reported from their paper, is the risk of this outcome for the typical poor child divided by the risk for the typical non-poor child. So it just gives you a sense of the disparity in these outcomes across poor versus non-poor children. And so what you can see is that the disparities start out very early in life. So low birth weight is a very typical and important measure of health capital that the child takes into life and has been shown to be very important predictor of adult health and economic outcomes, interestingly. So the disparity starts at birth, and you can see how the disparity looks like it might grow a bit if you look at the difference between, say, grade repetition and high school dropout. In addition, quite large disparities in health and so on. So the disparities are significant between poor and non-poor children. Interestingly, and this is from a recent paper by Sean Reardon at Stanford School of Education, and he's making the argument that socioeconomic status, or differences across income groups, is a much more important dimension of disparity than black-white differences, which is traditionally what many of us social scientists have focused on in a key kind of disparity sense. So what this graph is showing, and there's kind of a lot going on here, is that the colored in symbols represent differences in income disparities on educational outcomes. This is all about educational outcomes. Whereas the open circles are observations about disparities, black-white. And he's pooling information across multiple surveys of different measuring education in different settings at different points in time. The smooth lines are meant to help give some guidance about the basic trends over time. So he uses this to conclude that the black-white education gap is becoming less important. That's the sort of downward sloping dashed line. Whereas the socioeconomic status income gap, that is the differences in outcomes between lower income and higher income individuals, is growing over time. So he's been out there really making this argument that we really need to focus on the income disparities, not because the black-white disparities aren't important to focus on, but let's spend some more attention on the income disparities, which haven't received as much attention in the greater social science literature. So one other feature to just sort of illustrate the disparities is to point out that, and this is also work by Greg Duncan and Catherine Magnuson, and this is illustrating differences, again, in an education outcome. This is a math achievement score. Comparing the differences in math scores at first grade and kindergarten, the blue line, and fifth grade, the lighter pink line, and showing those disparity differences across different groups. So the first panel, and this kind of hard to read the writing there, is comparing the bottom 20% of the income distribution to the top 20% of the income distribution. The second column is differences between blacks and whites. So by comparing these first two panels, one can see that the income, again, the income disparities are greater than the black-white disparities in terms of this outcome, which is a math test score outcome in elementary school. So this is all by way of simply pointing out the importance of poverty, and therefore an interest in trying to spend some more time talking about it. So what I want to do now is clarify and point out just the how important the labor market is for the poor. And I think that there's a sort of common presumption that the vast majority of the poor are not working and are just receiving government assistance. And that's not true. Most poor families have earnings in them. And most poor families have some kind of government assistance as well. But what's more important than that is the strong determinant of poverty over time being opportunities in the labor market, both in terms of job opportunities and, critically, the wages paid at those jobs. And so I want to talk about that a little bit. So observation one is simply poverty is very cyclical. So the three kind of local peaks of this poverty trend over time in the US occur at the three, you know, pits of the three most recent large recessions, 1983, 1993, and 2010. Poverty lags just a little bit, typically the depth of the recession, as does employment growth for the most part. Secondly, if we look between 2000 and 2010, so 2000 would have been the peak of the last cycle, of the last big cycle in the late 1990s, where unemployment rates were the lowest that they'd been in the last 40 or more years. What I've done here is on the x-axis, every point here is a state. On the x-axis is by how much did unemployment rates increase between 2000 and 2010. And there, you know, the Great Recession had enormous variation in the severity across areas in the United States. The y-axis is the overall poverty rate in the state. So this is simply another way of showing you that these two things move together. The higher the unemployment shock, the larger the increase in poverty. So the poverty is very tightly connected to the strength of the labor market in terms of the availability of jobs. I think I'll skip that in the interest of time. It's also very connected to the labor market in terms of the returns that those jobs are paying. So this is a really important graph that I hope is large enough for you to be able to read. So this plots over time back to 1965-70, depending on the year of the data available, and plots simply the real median household income by educational attainment of the head of household. And these are in real terms, right? So what you can see is that households that are headed by someone with less than a high school degree are experiencing a reduction in the income in their households throughout this entire period. In contrast, and you pretty much see that for the second line, which is those with a high school degree, and even those with some college is not really showing much growth. So where all of the growth in income is in the United States is concentrated among the highly educated. And this is pretty much true throughout this whole period. So as incomes in less educated families are declining, because primarily wages in those for less skilled workers are declining in real terms, there's sort of a theorem that that's going to lead to higher measured poverty. So at the same time that I showed you that long trend of what's happening to poverty, the returns in the labor market to individuals with less skills are just declining in the United States. Another way of looking at this is to look at the value of income across each one of the five quintiles of the income distribution, the bottom 20%, the next 20%, and so on, up to the highest top 20% of the income distribution. And in each year, we can calculate the mean level within that group and adjust for changes in prices. And so what you can see is that the bottom 20% of households in the United States, just another way of showing the same information, but just not cutting on it on education, you can see that those at the bottom of the distribution simply have not made progress, whereas there's a lot of gains in the top of the distribution. Now, a more extreme version of this sort of gets to our interesting debate and discussion in the United States right now, kind of, about the 99% versus the 1%. So essentially what I've shown you here is what's going on, not for the 1%, but the top 20%. What's kind of interesting and really important is the work that Emmanuel Saez and co-authors is doing that highlights just how much inequality is going up and how much it's concentrated at the very, very top of the income distribution. So in this graph here, what I'm showing, and this is just grabbing from Emmanuel's work, is the black line is the top 1%. So it's the same sort of figure, except instead of just showing how much individuals, the real values within this group, it's showing what fraction of all income in the United States in a given year is accounted for by those in this group. So those in the top 1% of the population back in 1973 were earning about 8% of total income in the United States. The top 1% earned 8%. Now, at the middle of the 2000s, they're earning more like 20% of the total income. So this is a measure of inequality that's very concentrated at the top of the income distribution. The blue and the red lines are the same sort of feature, but for the balance of the top 5%, the top 2, 3, 4, and 5, and then between 5 and 10. So what's kind of interesting about this is just in pointing out just how concentrated these gains are at the very top of the income distribution. I mean, the blue and red line guys, they're doing okay. I'm not worried about them. But it's interesting that the top 1% is so highly increasing, while even the near top 1% are just sort of moving along. So yes, what's going on in talking about poverty is sort of part of the same feature as what's happening at the top of the income distribution. That's the point of this concentration. And just one other feature about the importance of the labor market before going on to talk about government policies. What this shows here is, again, breaking up the income of all Americans into five equal groups, the bottom 20%, the next 20%, and so on, to the top 20%, and then also the top 5%. And showing two different time periods in the United States. The dark bar is the period, the post-war through 1973 period. These were really good days for everybody. And what's happening to real income growth within these groups between 1947 and 1973? The lighter bar is between 1973 and 2009. And so what is so striking about this comparison is the post-war through 1973 period, incomes rose, you know, kind of across the board. Yet in the next period, income growth was very concentrated at the top of the income distribution. So the point by showing this contrast here is just to point out that this is not something that has been historically throughout the history of time part of the evolution of incomes in the United States. And is a really important part in a basic explanatory measure of why poverty has not gone down despite the fact that we're spending a lot of money trying to fight it. So I just want to point out that the old adage of a rising tide raises all boats, that's what it is, it doesn't really work out with poverty. And so that bar graph in the past kind of is meant to illustrate that. In terms of, on the right-hand side here, I just plot GDP per capita in real terms. And GDP per capita is like a measure of wealth of the country. How rich are we? GDP per capita, kind of a standard measure. And what's interesting is if you look, you just see this kind of secular march forward. And yeah, you can sort of see how the Great Recession affected GDP per capita, but in the history of this period, it doesn't look that big a deal. Yet at this over this evolution of a kind of march forward of increases in GDP per capita, we see poverty sort of staying pretty much the same. So the point is simply that it's not a theorem that increased growth reduces poverty. It depends on what is happening with that increased growth. So with that background about what poverty is, how we measure it, the critical importance of the labor market, I now want to spend, you know, most of the rest of the time talking about government policies, what policies can make a difference and why, and what policies we might not expect to make a difference, and to sort of contrast them against each other. And then at the end, I'll sort of close in talking about that in the context of the Great Recession. So let's first establish what I would call the safety net in the United States. And again, with my focus in this talk primarily about families with children, it's the safety net for families with children. So we've got cash welfare, which is now called TANF. We've got food stamps, which is now called SNAP, which is vouchers that you can spend at the grocery store on essentially all food products. We've got the earned income tax credit, which is something I want to spend a particular amount of time on because most people don't know much about it, and it's the biggest anti-poverty program in the United States in terms of the number of people it moves out of poverty. We've got health insurance for low-income families through Medicaid and SCHIP, And then there's some other programs, subsidized housing, other food and nutrition programs. Some people consider minimum wages part of the safety net, and they are sort of in a way. I'm going to make an argument why minimum wages are not an effective anti-poverty program. They might be good to have for other reasons, but not if your primary goal is to reduce poverty, and we'll talk about that. In gray, which you might not really be able to see, but that's okay because I'm not going to talk about them, and that's why I put them in gray, there are two other elements which most people would consider part of the safety net, and that is unemployment insurance, and the other is Social Security. Unemployment insurance is not means-tested, and I'm focused on programs that are means-tested, so that's why it's a really important program as an insurance measure in recessions, but it's not the focus of my emphasis here today. And it's the incidence of receiving poverty among the poor is not so high. Typically, if you've got a good enough job to get a good UI payment, you're typically above poverty, as it turns out. Secondly, Social Security is primarily, although not solely, for individuals over age 62 or 65, so it's not really at the core of what I want to talk about today. So there, over the last 15 years, we've seen a tremendous change in the safety net, going back to that list of safety net programs in the United States, and I want to sort of summarize it in this figure. So what I plot here are expenditures per capita, not per recipient, just per capita in each year, in real terms, $2,009 dollars, for the three biggest cash or near cash programs for low-income families. The solid blue line is cash welfare, what used to be called AFDC and is now called TANF. And that black vertical line is when welfare reform occurred in 1996 under President Clinton. The red line is food stamps, which is now called SNAP. And the black line is the earned income tax credit. And all I'm doing here is just plotting how much money are we spending on these programs per capita. It would look pretty much the same if I just had the total spending. And then these gray barred areas are periods of national recession, the official dating of recession. So in this graph, which pretty much summarizes like almost everything I'm working on right now, I'm working, my own research is primarily focused on the red line, the food stamp program, and the EITC, the black line, mostly because, wow, those are the programs where there's a lot going on. I was doing a lot of work on the blue line, cash welfare, but cash welfare, poof, it's gone. So we reformed welfare, there's a lot fewer people on it, and we're spending less money on it. So that occurred. What I want to do is talk about the contrast of the earned income tax credit against cash welfare for the purposes of poverty reduction. And so I want to talk about and contrast those two programs along with some basic economics in order to illustrate why the EITC would be expected, and does, remove many more people from poverty than cash welfare, even back before 1996. So as an aside, before I go on, although I'm not going to talk about it too much further, you can see that the food stamp program has always been a bit more cyclical than cash welfare. And that's because the nature of the structure of the program means that a lot more people are on food stamps who are working but still get some aid, whereas cash welfare traditionally has been primarily an out-of-work benefit. And so that's why food stamps sort of moves a bit more with the cycle. But the Great Recession is a huge outlier. The food stamps have really responded to the Great Recession, which I would argue, you know, there was all this conversation in the election about, you know, Barack Obama, the food stamp president. I don't think he really did very much. But the point is, without food stamps, things would be much worse off at the bottom of the income distribution in the Great Recession. And so I'll show you some figures about that in a little bit. So, like I said, what I want to do is, this is the hopeful part. Okay, everybody, like we're transitioning from sad times into hopeful times. I want to talk about the earned income tax credit and why the structure of this program makes it a very successful anti-poverty program in the United States. And I want to contrast that to cash welfare. And the key reason that the EITC, hopefully, leads to more poverty reduction than cash welfare is because the earned income tax credit is an in-work subsidy. So you have to be working to get any earned income tax credit. And what the program has done is transfer resources to low-income families while encouraging entry into the labor market. And it's been tremendously successful in doing so. And so what I want to do is tell you a bit about what the earned income tax credit is and try to illustrate why it has this feature and how it's different from out-of-work assistance through cash welfare. So first of all, it's a tax credit, which means it offsets your taxes owed dollar for dollar. It's refundable, which means it can reduce your taxes owed not just to zero, but it can reduce your taxes owed to a refund payment. So most EITC recipients actually receive a tax refund. It's a program that's essentially for individuals with children. There's a very small credit for childless individuals, but it's not very important in the scheme of things. To give you an idea of how large a payment it can be, if you're a family with two children in 2010, you could get a maximum of $5,000 credit, which, as you can imagine, relative to low earnings, is a large increase in family income. And one element of Obama's stimulus package in 2009 was actually to provide a larger benefit for families with three or more children. This increased value right there was part of the temporary stimulus package. I thought it would be interesting to remind everybody, although it seems so long ago now, about Romney's infamous 47% comment about individuals who don't pay income taxes in the United States. So indeed, the earned income tax credit recipients are part of the 47, proudly, I suppose, part of the 47%. According to the Tax Policy Center, their response to the 47% argument was to educate people about it. Here's the group of folks who pay income taxes. Among the individuals who don't pay income taxes, the individuals who are receiving benefits for children, that's 7% of the total pie, these would be the EITC recipients. And so you can see how big that group is as a share of the 47% by contrasting it to, for example, elderly individuals, many of which don't have to pay income taxes because Social Security is not taxable, for example. So it gives you some perspective on that comment. But getting back to the EITC, this is the structure of the program. So here the x-axis is a family's earned income, and the y-axis is how big an EITC credit do they get. So the point here is if you don't work, if you have no earnings, you have no EITC. But for every dollar that you earn, the credit increases until you max out the credit, and then it stays constant for a little while, and then eventually the credit is phased out. Otherwise, we'd have to give the credit to everybody. You have to phase out a program eventually. And the credit is then phased out at a relatively flat rate, hopefully not discouraging too much work out in this region. So what the research has shown is the fact that this credit is distributing additional income. So this is a redistribution program that's bundled with an incentive to enter the labor market. So if you're sitting there and not working and trying to contemplate your next move, the fact that the EITC is there or expands over time would add to your calculation of the benefits associated with work. And it turns out that much research has demonstrated, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that this program and its expansions in the 1990s had huge, show you something. I'm out of order here. Crud. I just wanted to show you this because I was about to say something and it comes later in my slides. The research on the EITC has shown quite dramatically and convincingly that increases in employment among less skilled single mothers in the 1990s, much of it is tied to the expansion of the EITC. So what's really interesting is, and I really should have this graph go all the way back to the 1960s, there had been much hand-wringing over the decades about the fact that single mothers with children, that's the solid blue line, had such low employment rates. It always sort of bothered me, by my own standard of normative views, that this was never a concern raised about married women with kids, but that's just my own view about redistribution and not my scientific view. But nonetheless, much of the policy action in the 1990s was focused on getting low-income single mothers with kids into the labor market. And so this very much was manipulated by reforming welfare and expanding the EITC. And quite amazingly, and it would show it more amazingly if I had this graph going back to the 1960s, this increase in employment in the 1990s is very large. Like social our policies don't usually work this well, and it really did. And part of the reason seems to be that we've learned is that latter part of the 1990s happened to also be in an unbelievably strong labor market for less skilled workers. I don't have that on this graph, but that seems to be part of why it was so effective. But what you can see is as we move into the 2000s and the decline in jobs that occurred, the employment rate is decreased some, but pretty much in lockstep with the other groups. So it doesn't look as though that those efforts have disappeared in the Great Recession. So the EITC turns out to be a really key feature of the safety net that most people don't know about, because it's sort of invisible because of how it operates through the tax system. And how the EITC reduces poverty is, number one, because we're putting more money in individuals' pockets, but number two, because we're also encouraging more work. And so you mechanically see increases in household income occurring not just from the hand out, but the hand up. It's kind of the term, hand up, not a handout. So what this graph shows you is just, well, how has the EITC changed over time, just so you can have some idea about what our policies are doing. And this is in real terms, and this is just the maximum credit a family could receive. And so what you can see is, there's these various expansions, very notably in 1993, where we expanded benefits, especially for individuals with two or more children. So with that backdrop of this policy, why would we necessarily expect that this would improve poverty? So here's where you get into like basic econ, principles. So what I have here is the x-axis is earnings, and the y-axis is after-tax income. So the red line is just, in a world where all of our income was just earnings, this is the relationship between what we earn and what we have, just the 45-degree line. The black dashed line is kind of approximately, this is a stylized diagram, this is not meant to be like actually accurate, but just to show you why the EITC would be expected to reduce poverty. The black dashed line is approximately where the poverty line is. So if we want to reduce poverty, we got to move all these guys with incomes below this point up to the black dashed line, and that would get rid of poverty. In fact, there's a term called the poverty gap, which is different than the poverty rate. And the poverty gap is all the dollars we would need to bring everybody up to poverty. So in this graph, it would be like the area of this triangle multiplied by the number of people or something like that, like integrate that out. But here I'm just trying to illustrate what the EITC does. So this red line is a world of no government. So the blue line now is approximately what the EITC does, how it moves earnings and how it increases, not how it moves earnings, how it increases after-tax income. And so what's interesting about how we've structured the EITC is the range in which it's providing a lot of assistance is very much kind of in the range of the poverty line. So there's a lot of people, there's a very significant density of the income distribution between, 10 and $15,000 a year, actually, And that's really the sweet spot of the EITC. So there's a lot of people in that range, and by supplementing their incomes through this credit while also attracting people into the labor market, we create this reduction in poverty through those two different mechanisms, through direct redistribution and through incentivizing work, therefore bringing more earnings into the household. So some folks may move from being right here and maybe having some small government assistance, which I don't, welfare or something that I don't have in this graph, into moving into the labor market at some kind of minimum wage, plus the EITC gets them out of poverty. That's mechanically, realistically, how it works. So if I make this argument that the EITC has this feature, I want to contrast it briefly against cash welfare. So what is, I've sort of said cash welfare or TANF or AFDC many times, but what exactly is it within this kind of concept of translating earnings into after-tax income? The key thing is that we provide really low benefits on our out-of-work assistance. So here we are back to a world with just no government and the red line. Now I'm going to add in the typical cash welfare benefit, you know, like the right magnitude of the cash welfare benefit that we offer in the United States, and it looks like this. So the typical state might offer something like $400 a month for a family of three. And then, as you earn more, phase that out quick at a pretty steep rate. The point of this is that we can provide a lot of aid down here, and I'm not saying that it's not important. I think it's actually really important and addresses more extreme poverty. But movement down here is not going to get anybody over the black dashed line because we simply don't have funding of this program in a sufficient level that we would ever expect it to move anybody over the black dash line. So we would have to increase this program like threefold in its generosity to expect that cash welfare will move anybody out of poverty. So cash welfare might be an important part of understanding what the gap is, reducing the poverty gap, but it does diddly squat to affect poverty. And so part of the punchline here is we need to think about the right programs to address the problem that we're interested in. So that's the EITC versus cash welfare, I think makes the sort of strongest comparison of policies that are going to be effective at reducing poverty versus policies that are going to be less effective at reducing poverty. Two other things that I want to talk about. One is food stamps. What's really important about food stamps in the United States is it's the only program that is universal. So in other words, if you're low income, you can get food stamps, regardless of do you have kids or not, are you a single parent or not, are you, you know, whatever, except non-citizens. So it's a universal program, and I think of it as the universal safety net in the United States for that feature. And as I showed you in that first graph, it's been really responsive in the current recession, and I want to just show you a little bit more about that. I already showed you this graph. Let me show you a couple of others. So what I show here is the blue line is the total number of unemployed persons in the United States relative to the beginning of the recession, so normed to one at the beginning of the Great Recession. So the blue line shows just how steep our movement into the recession was. It's unemployment, right, so it's going up. And the black line is where we officially say the recession is over, although it's always the case that employment lags. You know, the recession being pretty much the timing of the recession is all about GDP and it's not about jobs. And so the blue line is staying pretty stubbornly high. The black dotted line is the aggregate food stamp caseload in the United States, again, normed back to one at the beginning of the Great Recession. And so you can see that the food stamp caseload has really increased with need. The red dashed line is TANF, or cash welfare, and you can see that it's really not changing very much. So the point is that the food stamp program is providing a lot of protection in the Great Recession, and cash welfare is not. Another way to show that same fact is to go back to this idea that I showed you before about each point on the graph being a state. Again, the x-axis is the change in the unemployment rate, and here I think I have between 2007 and 2009, so it's the immediate Great Recession period. And the size of the dots are bigger for bigger states. So, and then the y-axis on the left-hand graph is the percent change in the food stamp caseload. So what you can see is that, wow, states that had bigger shocks in the Great Recession had bigger increases in protection through food stamps. On the right graph, I've got the same idea, except now I'm showing TANF. Now, the scales are not the same on the y-axis because TANF is mostly negative, so it wouldn't really show up if I put it on the same scale of food stamps. But the reason why I'm showing this is to show not only is TANF not going up, it's not even going up more in places where there's more need. So it's just not providing protection in the current Great Recession. It's post-welfare reform. So finally, before going on to talk about the Great Recession and sort of bringing this all together, I did want to just talk briefly about minimum wages. Because it's kind of an obvious policy that one would, you know, I made all this argument about how the labor market and returns in the labor market are really important for poverty. Well, shouldn't the minimum wage be a good lever to use? And the problem is it's extremely untargeted. So if you go to the data, and I should have a slide in this just to show you, because it's pretty compelling, what fraction of individuals who receive the minimum wage who live in families that are poor or even near poor is very small. George, I don't know, can you tell me? I can't remember off the top of my head what it is, but it's shockingly low. The most common group of individuals who receive the minimum wage is, of course, teenagers. And many of them in not low-income families. So while there might be a lot of important reasons to have a minimum wage, and I don't want to argue against that, it is not an efficient anti-poverty tool because it's not targeting the group that you're really interested in. So there are many minimum wage workers who live in poor families, but there are many more minimum wage workers who are in families that are not poor, and so it's not targeted enough. Is the idea. So with that summary of what these programs can do, how about I give you some facts about what these programs have done? And so we can make the argument that if we spend money on these programs, we can generate some poverty improvement. Of course, the challenge is that the official poverty statistics don't measure food stamps or the earned income tax credit. So literally, armed with a viewpoint, one could go up there and say, we spend all this money on these programs, and look, the poverty rate literally doesn't change. But it turns out that, you know, the way the official poverty rate is measured, it doesn't include these measures, so there's no way to show improvement. So I was incredibly happy when the Census Department last year released for the first time the supplemental poverty measure. And with the supplemental poverty measure, we now have a sort of seal of approval, gold standard measure that we can point to and evaluate what these programs do. So let's talk about that. So the thing that I want to focus on is the fact that this measure includes in-kind benefits as well as is an after-tax measure. And that's the focus of my interest here. But there's also several other changes that the supplemental poverty measure has implemented, including geographic variation in the cost of living, including accounting for out-of-pocket medical expenses as a deduction against your income before calculating whether or not the individual is poor. as well as expanding the notion of the family unit to include cohabiting couples, and many other changes. So I want to tell you a little bit about what this new figure, what we can conclude from it. So it was not necessarily meant that this figure would necessarily raise or lower poverty, but for people as a whole, poverty is slightly higher under the supplemental poverty measure. I don't think that part is very important. I think what's important is to use the measure in order to evaluate programs and to look for differences across groups. So quite notably, when you look at the differences by age, which if you remember was the first thing that I showed, and I talked about, you know, the success in reducing poverty for families with an individual age 65 or older, interestingly, and it makes sense, we've been putting a lot more resources into programs for families with children like the EITC and primarily food stamps. So what that's going to do is overall lower poverty rates for children. But interestingly, raise poverty rates significantly for the elderly, and that feature is purely because of the new deduction for out-of-pocket medical expenses. So because a non-trivial share of the elderly have large medical expenses, that deduction against their income can lower their income enough to put them below the poverty line, and that's what explains this difference. So this could actually be really important for understanding the sort of distribution of poverty with this new measure. You can also see how the differences in the cost of living have led to differences in what happens to poverty across states. So the lighter shaded states are states where the new supplemental poverty measure is higher than the official poverty measure. I can't remember higher by how much, I can't remember, other than being statistically higher. I don't remember. And the dark shaded states are states where the darkest shade, they're not statistically different. And the medium shade, the supplemental poverty measure is lower than the official poverty measure. And so what you generally tend to see on average is higher cost states like your state of New York and my state of California are moving to the supplemental poverty measure, experiencing increases in poverty rates compared to the official measure. Whereas lower cost areas like much of the Midwest and the South, moving to the supplemental poverty measure leads to reductions in their poverty rates. So there's a kind of an interesting geography to the movement comparison of the supplemental poverty measure. But what I really want to focus on is what the safety net does. And so this is really the sort of summary graph that kind of culminates what I've been talking about in this talk. So what this does is it takes the supplemental poverty measure, and this is for children, and we imagine that we eliminate a program and then ask what happens to poverty rates, or it's actually the reverse. They add the program back in, so it reduces poverty. And we do this, and what I've demonstrated here is what that calculation looks like for these elements of the safety net that I started the description, this section of the talk with. The earned income tax credit, food stamps or SNAP, Social Security and disability insurance, housing subsidy, and so on. The red bars, I've just delineated the programs that I couldn't measure until we had the supplemental poverty measure. Whereas the blue bars are cash income and things we could have already measured before in the official poverty measure. So the point here is that the EITC is the biggest anti-poverty program for children in the United States. And the calculation shows that without the EITC, about another 5 million children would be in poverty. Food stamps removes another 2 million children from poverty. And those are the two biggest anti-poverty programs in the United States for children. On the other hand, in contrast, what we were talking about before, TANF, has a relatively small reduction in poverty. I was a little bit surprised to see such a large role for Social Security, but I think what's going on there is many children live in households that also have individuals that are receiving Social Security in it. I was surprised to see that it was as large as it was, looking at children. You can contrast this, or you can see this, for all persons as a whole in the United States. And the largest anti-poverty program in the United States as a whole is Social Security. And you can see that most dramatically if you limit the calculation to the elderly, where you see basically everything that's eliminating poverty is going on in the Social Security program, which is fantastic. But a program that we spend a lot of money on is only the observation, that it's not any great mystery about why it's effective. It's funded at a really great level, providing a lot of protection for individuals in retirement. So with this, I just want to end in talking about the Great Recession, or just tie up a few things to try to make this point about what the safety net can do. So here I'm just reminding you of just how severe the increase in the unemployment rate was in the Great Recession. And if you look at the official poverty rate, what you'd see is that it increased a fair amount between 2007 and 2009. That's the blue bars. And I've put the unemployment rate there just for reference. So you can see that, you know, wow, when the unemployment rate went up, poverty went up. But what's kind of fantastic is that the red bar is the poverty figure that builds in the safety net, that is excluded from the official poverty measure. And quite amazingly, poverty by that more inclusive measure, which I would argue is the better measure to begin with, didn't change very much in the Great Recession. So it's sort of a good news, bad news story. Like, poverty's high in America, but the point is that in this severe Great Recession, the safety net is doing its job. And a lot of that has come through food stamps. In terms of, you know, the figures that I showed you about how many people are lifted from poverty from the EITC and food stamps, this is really more about year to year, what is changing that's filling in the gap. It's primarily food stamps and some EITC. So this is the look, government policies can make a difference. So before I conclude, and we'll have plenty of time for questions if you have them, I wanted to tell you about, you know, this is sort of a postscript of two things that are sort of on the frontier of new work on poverty that I thought I would just mention. The first is what I'm calling, anyways, the new biology of poverty and the importance and relationship between socioeconomic status, income, stress, and cortisol. So it's been known for some time that cortisol, which is the stress hormone, which we know leads to really bad things in terms of health, longevity, life expectancy, metabolic syndrome and high blood pressure and things like that. We've known I didn't know, but it has been known for some time that there's a gradient in cortisol levels across socioeconomic status, with lower income individuals exhibiting higher levels of cortisol, which is bad. But what's new is some, what I think, really exciting social science research that's using strong quasi-experimental designs and some randomized experiments that seems to show that that cortisol level is manipulatable. So a couple of studies I'll mention. One, a conditional cash transfer program in Mexico at the core of the social welfare policies in Mexico, something called PROGRESA. And it's been evaluated through randomized experiments. And that a recent paper looking at that program shows that cortisol levels decreased after receipt of the conditional cash transfer. Like providing more resources in the household, cortisol levels decline. Another recent study shows that the earned income tax credit leads to reductions in cortisol levels and stress levels among mothers. And it's been shown that in another study that the prenatal maternal cortisol level is quite negatively associated with not just the health of the baby at birth, but amazingly, their well-being through childhood and into early adulthood. So cortisol, I still don't know very much yet, but this is one of the frontiers of work on poverty, is trying to understand this and understand the extent to which we can manipulate it through government policy. So that's sort of where the economists and the psychologists are sort of coming together. That's one area that I'm very excited about. Another area that I'm quite excited about is in recognizing that many programs that we're funding seem to have benefits far beyond today. So our typical sort of cost-benefit analysis to decide whether or not the Earned Income Tax Credit, for example, is a program that's worth having, are very typically based on sort of contemporaneous calculations of costs and benefits. You get a lot more bang for your buck if you can, if it's so that providing more of a safety net today can lead to better outcomes down the road. And so there's a couple of examples of this that is a kind of growing area of interest in economics. One shows quite dramatic improvements in college going and a reduction in criminal activity for individuals who have participated in Head Start, an early childhood education program early in life. So what's interesting is we've sort of focused on test scores, and it looks like Head Start improves test scores and then they fade away by early elementary school, which is like, ugh, what happened? The test score effects fade away. Well, the second generation of work seems to find that there are some gains to these kids that show up again in adolescence and in young adulthood that we think might be related to non-cognitive skills, so it doesn't show up in the test scores. It's still in progress trying to understand this. And the same thing is true about small class sizes. So small class sizes lead to improvements in test scores. They fade away. We're like, oh, they fade away. Why does that happen? It turns out that the second generation of work on this shows that some of these studies show that an improvement in college going and wages in young adulthood. We still don't really understand what's going on there. It might be non-cognitive skills that aren't measured in the test scores. And some work that I'm going to be talking about a little bit tomorrow as a preview to my second lecture on campus tomorrow is going to be talking about some new work I have that relates access to food stamps in early life and connections to later life health and economic outcomes. So it seems as though providing a better safety net in childhood generates benefits in adulthood. And that's sort of work that no one's really focused on that before. So all of this work is very much in its infancy, but it gives me some additional optimism moving forward about trying to make the argument that redistribution and safety nets yield important benefits to society. So I would love to take any questions that any of you have. I hope I didn't crowd out too much time to do that. And thanks again for having me. Sure, no, I'd be happy to call on people. Yeah.
Oh, wait. Stand up and speak loudly, and that's the way other people will hear you.
The cortisol, the first thing you said that we are paying for Social Security. I think indeed that's payroll tax, so you're not paying any of our taxes, and indeed the Social Security went into the general fund, so it's quite the opposite of we are paying. We are receiving from that payroll tax. It is paid by a certain segment of the population, and we have yet to have that paid back from the general fund. But on the cortisol, I'm wondering if it was controlled for. There have been findings that cortisol levels rise
Right. Thank you. Your point about Social Security is of course correct, that it's Social Security is not paid out of the general fund. The point, however, I think is still that there's an enormous amount of redistribution that goes on in Social Security. So some individuals are paying more and some individuals are paying less, and there's a lot of redistribution that goes on. So I think of it as a social welfare program, even though we're mostly paying each other within generations, as opposed to me paying for my grandmother's benefits. But I think it, you know, it should be known that it's a social welfare program, but it's not really viewed in that light. On the cortisol, I think you're absolutely right about this, and I think it's been very tricky in these studies to have interviewers come into homes and grab blood from individuals. And so there's apparently been a lot of work on how you need to structure when the blood test comes in the interview to kind of warm up and create a relationship with these individuals. And I think it matters also who you're portraying yourself as. I'm the government guy coming in to do this, as opposed to how it's sort of being couched. And I'll have to go back and look at those studies and see a little bit more about how they do that. But I know that it's been something that's paid a lot of attention to as to when they do the blood draw part of it for exactly that reason. Yeah, in the back. Yeah. So there's been very little discussion about the EITC, which I take as good news. Despite the fact that there was that kind of moment when there was a lot of discussion about the non-payers, there doesn't seem to be much discussion about the EITC that I'm hearing on the tax side of the budget negotiations. Although the stimulus did include a temporary increase in the EITC as well. I don't think I mentioned it. Also an increase for food stamps. So those would go away and, you know, maybe should, you know, I guess, maybe, but are expected to go away. The automatic reductions that would occur if they don't create a plan would severely cut back food stamps. EITC not, because it's not a spending program by the classification of government programs. So even though it really is a spending program because it's within the tax system, the automatic cuts, whatever they're called, wouldn't apply to the EITC, but they would. The food stamp program is front and center for those reductions. I'm hopeful about the EITC, but. But we'll see. I'm one of these people who pays attention near the end when it seems like it matters, because I get so frustrated watching it as I go along. Yeah?
Well, I guess this extends this question in a way. It's another what would you do if you were president question. Let's suppose that there is a possibility of doing more to end this shocking situation where after half a century there hasn't been progress except among old people in reducing poverty. What would you emphasize? Because you talked about a lot of programs. Each seems to have its limitations. EITC might do what it does well, and yet it's not clear how it reaches to the really poor people, like
right.
5% of families,
right.
You have less than 10,000, and it does right encourage employers to orient themselves to some extent to low-wage
right.
jobs, because it substitutes them. You talked about downsides of TANF, despite ways in which it might be necessary for the people who suffer the most. Education, I know, is something that you implicitly mentioned, but it's hard and takes time
right.
to tell people that way. Infrastructure expenses, Good for people who are semi-skilled, perhaps not very helpful for other people.
Right.
So what would you emphasize if you were president and you had this mandate to make real headway?
I think that I probably would end up not talking about all that much of what I've talked about today, in the sense that I think we need, my view is that we certainly wouldn't want to cut back any further than we have. I think it's probably the case that the EITC has shown to be so successful without concerns. I mean, there was some concern that because you eventually have to phase it out, some people might work less in order to get more EITC. That doesn't seem to be the case. So I think there's scope to expand that further because it reaps, it's very efficient, and it also encourages more work. But I think that where we really need to make improvements and where we should be putting the next big chunk is absolutely in education. I mean, I think there's just no doubt about it. Now, part of it is where I sit in California, where funding per pupil is decreased as much as it has. But it's also the case that the more we learn, the more it seems to matter that our investment is earlier and earlier and earlier in life. So, you know, investments later down the road just are vastly less efficient than investments early in life, even in terms of these visiting nurse programs that are going on in households with highly disadvantaged teen mothers. So things I haven't talked about very much here today, I think are the areas where I would expand early in life through additional expenditures on making kids school ready and increasing more in spending in K through 12 education. And I think that I would, my read of the literature is that the tax rates in the top, say 30% of the income distribution could be a fair amount higher without distorting a lot. And it seems to me through the long lens of history, those are trade-offs that I as the social planner would be willing to make to create more equality across outcomes in the United States, because the disparities are just growing and growing, disparities on health outcomes and others, again, on the top and bottom of the distribution. So I think that everything we know tells us that the highest returns, given where our spending is right now, is earlier in life. And not necessarily through more food stamps or more EITC, but through more human capital investments. Yeah?
Just following up on the point you just made, with investing a lot more heavily in subsidized daycare and preschool programs,
right. I mean, I think high-quality daycare, absolutely. And an interesting observation is that countries that provide heavily subsidized daycare, our European, you know, counterparts, tend to create settings in which no one selects out to the private market. They all participate in the public market. And it's probably never going to happen here, but I think that there's something about social distance that we've created in the United States, and there's just not that many places where we're all together. And I think that that's part of what's creating disparities, is that difference. But, you know, aside from that point, I think it's undeniable that providing opportunities for individuals to be working and have the means for their kids to be well cared for seems to me to be an elemental part of what a rich country should do. And one that would yield benefits to that child's being better, you know, ready when K through 12 education begins. And I think all the research seems quite consistent with that as being a good investment. Yeah. Hi, John.
Can you go back to the graph with the employment rates by the different women?
Yes. Let's see.
Families.
Yep. Yeah.
The trends.
Oh, the trends. Did I have trends for what we think?
You had
I had employment. I'm sorry. You said employment, and I thought.
Right.
Yep. Sorry. Yes.
Yeah. The thing is that the TANF, the addition of EITC is growing throughout this.
Yep.
And it's not just hurting them. Really happening for that group, the single with children, is
It's definitely a combination of the two, for sure.
They were required both for work or to go into training. And so there's a real change in that program, and that's part of the reason why it's become smaller.
Of course.
Because of that. So that the kick up in employment on the part of the single with children parents is mainly the change in the rules.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the, you know, here's 1993 when the EITC expands. The big expansion. TANF was starting to be, you know, going on at the very, maybe 1989 and earlier. I think undeniably, first of all, I think it's hard to disentangle these things because they were going on at the same time. And all of the evidence we have suggests that the bang from the EITC was greater. It's the classic kind of carrot and stick approach that, you know, welfare reform created a bit of a stick. You know, requiring people to be looking for work and to be participating in the labor market, and the EITC sort of created a carrot in terms of increasing the returns to work. And it seems as though the interaction between those two things was quite important. I think from the work that I've read, maybe 40% is because of the EITC, 20% is because of welfare reform and the balance being the strong economy, something like that. So they're both incredibly important. And I don't mean to speak disparagingly about cash welfare. I might have my own view about how it should be structured. I think it needs to be there. I think we need a fundamental safety net that is not tied to the labor market. And if UI doesn't provide that for everybody, we need to have some cash assistance that does. But the program is what it is right now. And so my point was only that it's not doing much for poverty. Although it clearly had an effect on women's employment during this time period.
The EITC should have affected married with children.
Except that it turns out that
they tend to earn more money.
Not many are affected, and also as a secondary earner, they actually, theory says, their employment should go down, and it does modestly. It doesn't show up so much here, but yeah.
I can't tell you about our next speaker, because this is the end of our series. If you have thoughts about what a good next series would be, please let me know. I'm rwi5@cornell.edu. It's been terrific, the Hillary Horn's combination of economic insight and empirical rigor and compassion. I'm a philosopher, so I can be honored.
I know, we're not allowed to be.
Completed our series in so many ways, and who would have thought at the beginning completed it on a note of hope?